I was sitting in Girl Scout movies. Okay, let's get going. Welcome, everybody. How's everybody doing? Managed to get through all the snow and stuff? Okay. I hope everybody enjoyed the Assistive Technology Fair last Thursday and the Motion Gate Analysis Lab on Tuesday. Does anybody have any questions about what you saw and heard? Was it good? What was the best thing you saw at the Assistive Technology Fair? Yeah. What'd you like?
Me.
Oh, you liked yourself. You liked that you were there.
Promotion.
Yeah, sure. Nothing wrong with that. Yeah. Okay. Great. Yeah, that was the first time I had that event, and everybody seemed to enjoy it. The vendors liked it a lot, so we'll have it again next year. So the first thing I want to do is have an announcement by Yi about her program.
So, hi everyone. Thanks, Dave, for giving me a few minutes here. So my name is Yi Zhang, and I direct Global Innovation Programs with MIA. And essentially, we bring university students from Asia who are interested in learning about design thinking, interested in learning how they can impact the world's many problems in their future. We bring them to Stanford and help them see what kinds of issues and solutions are being generated here, and we have students from Stanford help coordinate that experience. So we have a summer program coming up called Exchange for Social Entrepreneurs and Leaders. It's a four-week program where students from Japan and Hong Kong who are trying to learn about these issues and see where they can make an impact are going to come to campus and go through a series of workshops and visit different organizations and also work on a project related to a social issue at home. It could be around education, poverty alleviation, aging society. We've had several projects actually on different assistive issues, technology as well. So looking for students from Stanford to share about their perspectives on different solutions here. And it's a really great experience learning about cultural exchange, how do you lead and learn from others in this cross-cultural context. So we have applications for the coordinator position. Deadline is March 11th, and for the coordinators, we provide housing and meals during the month at Stanford, and also $1,000 stipend to go back to Japan and Hong Kong to see the participants in their home context and get a taste of what social issues, what the community is like over there. We just had a student who led our summer program in 2012 go back to Japan in January, and she was hosted by all the students that she had met. She got to stay with them and see kind of where they're coming from. She said it was the best trip ever. So really hope that you'll join us this summer at the Exchange for Social Entrepreneurs and Leaders. You can find out more at theoprograms.org/BayArea/SEL for Excel. And I think the flyer will be in the slides that will be online later. And feel free to come talk to me after the class if you have any questions. So, thank you.
Thank you.
What?
Is that commentary? Okay. I graded all the midterm reports. I just wanted to show you a couple of the items that came up multiple times. And I'm not going to go through these. They'll be in the email I'm going to send out tomorrow. But I hope you will follow the suggestions that I marked in red on all your reports and include them in your final report. So if you have any questions about any of that stuff, please see me. On Tuesday, we went to the Motion Gate Analysis Lab, and we and Richard was kind enough to volunteer to get marked up these markers, and Somebody asked about the material that is used, and these are corner reflectors, and it's a three planes that are at right angles that are reflective, and when you have a situation like that, any incident angle gets reflected back along the same line from any direction. So these are the kinds of things that are used most famously on the moon. There's a panel of these that you can send a laser beam to, and it will bounce back at you to show that we've actually been to the moon. But they also, 3M also makes it in the tape like this, and you can fabricate them into marker balls like this, and that's what Richard was wearing. So you might have seen some of the photos that I took, flash photos I took, and from that you can see it's very reflective. So that's corner reflectors. So so in about 12 days, the 12th of March, are the students' final team presentations in this room. So it's the home stretch for teams. So please let me know if you have any issues, if you want me to weigh in on a decision. And if you have any problems or concerns, or just want to know more information about what's expected, please let me know. On Tuesday, we're going to the VA Medical Center, and we have a sign-up for carpooling. So please sign up. It ought to be a great event. As before, we'll meet here, and we'll carpool from here to the VA, which is only about 3 miles away. And we'll probably get back a little bit later than normal, so let me know if you have to be back earlier, and we can arrange for that. Students working on projects, please contact me, meet with me if you haven't done so already, so we can make sure that you're on the right track in this home stretch. There are three students who are working on individual projects, and their presentations are not during class time, but they're going to be on Thursday, March 7th in the morning. Anybody in the class is welcome to attend those, because it would be good for you to see them and evaluate what they've done, ought to be pretty interesting. So you're welcome to come to those. So toward the end of a project, things might go great, or some things may not work out as you expect, and so you should plan, if things don't work out exactly the way you think they would, if you don't have enough time, or the software doesn't work, or you just run out of time, please have a backup plan, and talk to me. You should also be thinking about not only your report, the presentation, but your report, and there's also an item that of individual reflection for students who are working on projects. And I appreciate any updates you might send, so I know that you're working diligently on your projects. So next Tuesday, as I said, we'll be at the VA Medical Center. We're going to be going to two areas, the spinal cord injury area, looking at some equipment that's used for folks who have had a spinal cord injury. We're going to be talking with Dr. Creasy, who was the chief of spinal cord injury there. And then just down the hall is a brain injury assistive technology lab, where we have a chance to get hands-on on a bunch of other equipment that they use for folks with brain injury. And there'll be things in there like power wheelchairs and memory devices and hand-powered bicycles, things like that. And there'll also be a veteran who will talk to us, somebody with a spinal cord injury, so you have a personal, get the personal element about brain injury and spinal cord injury. Since at the end of the day, there won't be a lot of patients around, so if you're you shouldn't be too apprehensive about meeting a lot of patients. But these people are all wonderful people. We've been to the VA before, and it's a great tour. So that ought to be pretty big. And a week from today, we'll have Ralph Hotchkiss here. He's an engineer from Berkeley, He's a wheelchair user, and he'll be talking about wheelchair designs for developing countries. It's going to be a great lecture. But today we have Peter Axelson, and before I introduce him, I want to mention that we're going to, since Peter flew in from Nevada, I only get to see him once a year. We're going to have a bunch of us are going to have dinner with him at Max's. So anybody who's interested in having dinner at a big table, please let me know so we can make arrangements for a big table. And we should arrive there at 6:30. Okay? You're all welcome. Okay, so what we'll do now is take a little break. It's an opportunity for you to sign in and sign up for a carpool. There's one handout here, and there's the evaluation page, and of course there's cookies. So we'll be back in a couple minutes. Exchange program is pretty neat, isn't it?
That gal's been on the program, so she knows what it's like.
What kind of project is that? There's
okay, let's get going. No, that's sort of hurtful. Just tell me.
Okay, I just did.
Yeah. I'll take a hand. Okay, let's get going. So it's my pleasure to have Peter here again. He's been here every year to talk in my class, and he's been a longtime colleague. I remember him from years and years ago when he was an undergraduate student here at Stanford. So Peter is a rehab engineer who had a spinal cord injury in 75 in a climbing accident at Air Force Academy. He continued his education here at Stanford, and I think you mentioned that you were one of the first students who was a wheelchair user.
The first one, right here.
He began applying engineering and design principles to overcoming daily living hurdles faced by people with disabilities. And in 81, he founded his company, Beneficial Designs, an engineering design firm dedicated to designing, developing, and testing assistive technologies. And among his many accomplishments include developing the first chairlift compatible monoski with a shock absorber, which he'll show us. He worked to establish wheelchair testing standards and developed a lot of seating systems for wheelchairs and creating systems to assess trails and outdoor trails and sidewalks. And so he's the founder and director of research and development at Beneficial Designs in Nevada. He spends much of his time traveling throughout the world and to California, attending meetings and presenting his work. He's also a pilot, and he has an adapted two-engine plane. Did you fly in San Jose?
Not this trip.
Okay, but he has before. So let's give a warm Stanford welcome to Peter Exeter.
The only reason I didn't fly in is that I submitted a major grant application today, and Dr. DeBray, my advisor, he can attest that when you work on major grant applications, you're up till 2 in the morning for like 2 weeks in a row getting it ready to submit, and I pretty much knew I wasn't going to be cognitively ready to fly an airplane, so Sam volunteered for my staff to drive me down. I got a couple hours sleep in the car, so that helped out. So I'm looking forward to sharing a lot of the things that I've gotten to work on over the years. Like Dave said, I was on a path to be an aerospace engineer working with wind tunnels and stuff at the Air Force Academy, and got sort of redirected into wasn't quite sure what, but under my advisor, Dr. DeBray's leadership, I very quickly figured out that there were all sorts of things that I was trying to figure out how to do that I couldn't do without adaptive things that didn't exist. And so I very quickly figured out that there was a field of assistive technology and rehab engineering, and started designing adaptive equipment to do a lot of the things that I wanted to continue to try to do in my life. So I'm going to take you through a tour of some of those. Beneficial Designs is up in Minden, Nevada now. We're just, if you've ever skied up at Heavenly and you look down in Nevada, that's looking down into Minden. And we're based there right by the airport. And I'm going to talk about some of the research, design, and education projects that we work on. This is our mission statement, is that we just basically believe that through assistive technology, believe that all people should have the ability to participate in all parts of life, work, leisure, and play. And by designing appropriate assistive technology, that gives people the functions that they need to be able to participate equally in life activities. And that way you don't actually really experience disability, because you're able to participate in life functions. Somebody can't participate in a life function, that's when you actually experience disability. And so it's very important to refer to the person first with an impairment or with a disability when you're writing and talking about people with visual impairments or mobility impairments. So I I've already kind of explained all that. So you don't accomplish things by yourselves. We have a team of about 10 people right now that do various things, the office tasks, leading projects, writing software, designing electronic circuit boards, machining parts, prototype parts, operating, doing assessments out on sidewalks, building test dummies, doing our shop work that's got to be done, making parts and prototypes, graphic artists on our team that designs maps and lays out projects. We've got a lab that includes these custom-built machines. This is a drum tester for wheelchair testing. This is a drum tester for power chairs. Most power chairs have 6 wheels on them, so you have to have 3 drums to test the 3 different drive axles, and the wheelchair actually drives the drum. There's a side view of that. The power chair is driving it. This is a machine that picks up and drops the wheelchair 7,000 times to look at the durability of it. It's like we don't get many volunteers to be the test dummy on that machine, but that's the machine there in the background. We have a tilt platform where we tip chairs to tilt them. We have a calibration chair we use to calibrate the dummy. This is the really fun part. This is the big test ramp where we take the power chairs out on it and we try to flip them over backwards and forward and sideways. And we do use human drivers on some of this testing sometimes to get the correct effect. And it's in the back of the hangar. The airplane's not in the hangar in this picture. And just standard, you know, bead blasting and powder coating and shop stuff and tools. And last year we were able to get a used CNC, so a Haas machine. So we're having fun with that, making parts. So I'm going to talk about a little bit about the product development process that I use when I'm designing things for people with different disabilities. I'm going to talk about how we go about assessing products and environments. I'm going to talk a little bit about universal design principles and how those benefit people with disabilities. First of all, when you look at mainstream products, there's lots of opportunities to incorporate universal design into those products to make them more usable by more people. When you buy a car now, the car company will put the hand controls in the car for you as part of buying the car. So they go as far as they can to design everything, and then they do adaptations for people with disabilities. But I'm going to talk also a lot about what I call sort of adaptive products, which are things that are specifically designed for somebody that has some kind of impairment. And they're either personal technologies that you wear or activity-specific technologies. First, I just want to talk about the fact that when somebody has a spinal cord injury or some sort of injury, or they're born with a disability, things are generally out of balance compared to the way life used to be, or the way that life might be to your friends and colleagues. If you have a physical disability, you know, there's certain things you just can't physically do anymore, and so everybody has certain priorities in their life in terms of how physical you are, you know, whether you're an outdoor person that likes to hike and bike and climb and swim and all that, or whether you're, you know, a mostly intellectual kind of person, and everybody's got a spiritual component to them in their life as well. So the idea is to try to help people get back to the balance point in those dimensions. And with that, I'm going to share a couple pictures. This is my daughter, Rhea, who just turned 9 this year. So we're out on a physical adventure here over the Snake River Canyon. This friend of mine built a ramp that literally goes right out over the canyon on the Snake River. He's in a power chair, so he likes to be able to drive out over the canyon on the Snake River to be able to look down, and that gives him his recharge. We'll have you at the end of the day. Since I have a 9-year-old daughter, I'm in the raft, sort of laying over the side of the raft on the right there, paddling away, strapped onto a bunch of life jackets so I can sort of kneel in the raft. And then she wanted to try zip lining. I thought, well, how am I going to do that? And so there were some pretty adventurous crew leaders there, and he said, well, maybe we could put one harness around my waist, and let's put another one on my knees, because if my legs hit the platform coming in, I'm going to break my legs. They're not very strong. And the only thing we didn't think out real well is the chest harness thing. I felt like I'd done about 300 chin-ups by the time I finished ziplining down. And once you start, you're you know, there's six more trees. You got to make your way down the process. And we used a motorcycle aluminum stand, and they went down with that first. There we go, knees and upper body. And my daughter had a blast, and she's like, "Daddy, can we go on the Grande now?" I'm like, "Maybe next summer, dear." So I am a physical person, and I ski and like to exercise and stuff. I do exercises every day for my shoulders, not to train as an Olympic skier anymore, but just to have the function that I need to be able to do the transfers and get in and out of my wheelchair and my car and everything else. And, of course, taking time for the spiritual parts. And that's what we're going to do tonight at Max's. We're going to have a little spiritual relaxation. Now, there's also a sociological dimension. Some people like to do things very independently, and people like to do things very interdependently. So addressing that can be a challenging issue. This is my hiking chair that I loaned to a friend of mine, and he ran into a situation where he couldn't get through the boulders, and in that case, he needed a little bit of help to get through. But even though he's a quad, he was able to work the brakes and go flying down the hills and have a good time. This guy that's going for the buddy jump here on the bottom, it's an escalator-dependent spinal cord injury quadriplegic. So he's wearing a little tiny scuba tank and designed his own free-flowing respirator, ventilator, so that he could breathe while he was doing the jump. And then they had to land the plane, get the ventilator back on the wheelchair and to the landing site in time before he ran out of air in his scuba tank. So that's determination for somebody that wants to do something. So pretty much, if somebody wants to do something, it may take a lot more work and a lot more energy and a lot more planning and a lot more adaptive equipment, but somebody will figure out how to do that. So we're looking at some extreme kind of examples there. This is my ultralight airplane that's adapted with ropes and things to do the ground steering, because my feet can't do the steering, obviously. And so here we're going to talk about now the personal technologies, activity-specific, environmental, and I'm going to cover through those things. Environmental technologies are basically things that don't move. They're things like that are attached. So like the ramps that are in this building, the railings, those are environmental technologies that make the building more accessible for everybody that wants to come into the building. Activity-specific technologies are things that are designed to go do a certain type of activity. So the first one I'm going to show you is my student project back to like 1979. And it's the Arroyo Sit Ski. And by sitting in it, it's got edges underneath so that you can turn and lean to carve turns in it. It doesn't have any edges on the outside, so it won't flip. But it's got a tunnel underneath, like a water skid, so the snow can go through it. And then those inside edges underneath, the front ones are facing out. So if you lean forward, it'll help you make a turn. So that was the first way we started skiing. And then once I figured out how to do molded seating from the folks at the Rehab Engineering Center at Stanford, at the Stanford Children's Hospital, I was able to monoski. So this is a monoski. It has a shock absorber in front there. It's a 4-inch travel Fox motocross shock. It's got a 4-bar linkage suspension, and it goes up and latches to get on the chairlift, and it's a molded orthotic seat that I'm sitting in. So this is back in my race days when I was racing on the U.S. Disabled Ski Team. Lots and lots of fun. I've been teaching now for 20 years. I teach and certify adaptive ski instructors. So if you like to ski and you want to do something a little different, there's an adaptive ski program up at Alpine Ski Meadows where you can become a volunteer and get a ski tickets and stuff for free if you volunteer and get involved with adaptive skiing. The one on the right there is called a bi-ski. It's mechanically articulating things so that when you lean to the left and right, the skis actually mechanically turn. So if you can hold on, just lean left and right, you can actually ski. So you don't have to have as much function. She's just having a blast riding the chairlift and getting off. So we test them to make sure we have standards for adaptive ski equipment, and I lead that committee. We have an evacuation standard for getting the equipment off the lift. If it breaks down, there's got to be a built-in evacuation harness in every piece of adaptive ski equipment. I don't have any back muscles, so when I lean forward, I pretty much just fall over. So I came up with this spring rod. It's just kind of a fishing rod that goes through a tube in my back. I'm wearing a harness around my chest. Spring rod plugs into a fishing rod ferrule in the back of my seat. And in whatever direction I flex, it bends the energy into that rod, and that rod helps me sit back up. And so it's basically sort of an artificial back muscle. This is a cross-country ski I designed. It tilts forward and it tilts back. So when I tilt forward, it stretches a bunch of bungee cords underneath there. And when I push through into the back, in the back here, it kind of snaps back and gives me that energy back. And it's almost sort of like a kicking lie when you're cross-country skiing. And so it gives that energy back. You get an increased range of motion and a little bit of extra energy back. This is a backcountry ski I designed. It's a mono ski with little adjustable outriggers on the side. And I've got a little seat recliner mechanism that I can release that and put those little outriggers down. But it allows me to ski on a cross slope. So I can adjust the outriggers to cross country ski on a cross slope. And then when I get done doing all the hard work going up, then I can retract both of those things up and then turn back into a mono ski and ski back down. So that's how that one works. This is the back support that I have in my wheelchair. It's a PAX back. That's my nickname, PAX. And it's an adjustable thing, so I can tighten it up nice and tight. I tightened it up when I came back into the room here. If I was going down a ramp, I would loosen it so I can lean back a little bit more. And I sit about an inch and a half taller with that on. You can see the rounded posture here and the straighter posture, so it helps you breathe better, helps you be more functional, more comfortable sitting, and allows you to change your sitting posture because everybody sits and moves around. When I travel on the airline, they have these horrible little straight back chairs to take you down the aisle of the plane to get to your seat. I don't like using those aisle chairs, so I've got these extra little wheels that are on my chair underneath the back, so I can pull the big wheels off when I get in the galley of the plane, and I call it the arm stroke. I just sort of pull my way down the aisle of the aircraft back to my seat, transfer into the seat, fold up my wheelchair, and then when I take all of these wheels off, they all quick release, then I can actually fit this part of the wheelchair into the overhead and with the wheels on top of it as well. This is Peter's pneumatic piano pedal pusher. There, I said it. It's got a simple beach pump bellows down here and comes up, and I've got a cummerbund around my waist, and I just pump it up and I tighten my stomach, and that pushes the sustentato pedal on the piano. I like to play the piano, so. Personal challenge, I was like, I want to try to drive a car with a stick shift. So I built a set of hand controls that I'm pushing down like a turn signal to push the clutch in, and then there's a cable there, so I twist it like a motorcycle for a throttle, and I push it forward for brakes. So on a hill, you know, when you're on a hill where you've got one foot on the brake and one on the clutch, and you're like, how do I push the throttle, and you put the parking brake on and try to put your foot to the throttle. And, you know, it's tricky to do just if you're normal on a hill, right, because you don't have three legs. Well, I can do it with one hand. Brake on, clutch in, rev the throttle, flip the clutch, and let off the brake with one motion with one hand. So it works pretty slick. This is, the people are still sitting on balls and stuff in their offices, right? They know what balance seating is about. Yeah, so it's basically like sitting on a ball. But the early versions of that were these balance chairs, they call them, and it has a rocker underneath it so you can rock. And I sort of modified it with some V-shaped pads so I could sit in there at my desk. And I worked on a wheelchair that had the same principle. So here I am in one of the three positions. It has a more rear position where my legs are sort of horizontal for driving around and going down hills. And I'm sitting in the most forward posture in this image where I would be sitting at a desk. It's a very, very comfortable chair to sit in. This is my hiking shoes. This is the chair that puts a smile on my face. When I get in this chair, it's just like, oh boy, fun. It's like a mountain bike wheelchair, basically. Going uphill is a lot of work, but going down is way, way, way fun. It has four-wheel disc brakes on all the wheels there, so I can break the right for my right brakes and the left for the left brakes. And I'm up on the top of Mount Washburn in Yellowstone Park in this picture. And then, like, if the trail sign says it goes to Fairy Falls, I mean, I want to get into Fairy Falls. I don't want to just get there. So I can go into about 12 inches of water before I start getting wet. This is a hand bike, and Doug Schwantz is not here today, but this was a student project that I sponsored at the Stanford Design Program. I wanted to be able to not just ride a three-wheeled hand cycle. I wanted to balance on two wheels. So what happens is this starts out on your training wheels, and then after you get going, you sort of pull those up, and then you're riding on two wheels, balancing left and right. There's still a tandem version of this bike on the market available. People that have spinal cord injuries or no sensation can't feel, or they're sitting, and the longer you have that injury, the more you become just skin and bone. So this is a contoured cushion that I've carved out of foam that allows me to sit for long periods of time. And this is some of that memory foam that was developed through the SPACE program. You see the commercials on TV for the Tempur foam mattresses and stuff. That same kind of foam, only this is sort of a higher grade version of that foam for therapeutic applications. And for testing seat cushions, we designed this thing that's not really skelly. We call it the gel butt. It's a skeleton inside of gel. So we use a plastic skeleton. We embedded it in the gel, and then we put that on a wheelchair cushion, and we can push down on it with a precise force. And then using a pressure map, we can look at the pressures in the cushion. So this is a regular foam cushion with the gel butt sitting on there, and you can see the as the color progresses, it gets, you know, worse as far as, you know, bad red, bad pressure, you know, blue, good, friendly pressures. So the pressure, the colors progress as the pressures get worse. So what we wanted to do is be able to test all different kinds of seat cushions for people that have obliquities and rotations and things like that, and different kinds of foam. So this just shows you six different kinds of cushions. You can see the difference. Well, Rojo's an air cushion. It does the best pressure distribution, but they're not very stable. So you can see how different cushions give very different pressure results. So we designed an adjustable skeleton inside the cushion so we could adjust it for different conditions. So in this case, it's twisted for a pelvic obliquity. It's tilted up to the side. In this case, that's the one that's tilted up onto the side. That one is rotated, tilted to the rear, and then the next one is actually rotated. So that's the one that's tilted. So you get the idea. You can move the bones around inside the foam to simulate different conditions. Either a rotation there, you can see the rotation. And so when I push it down into the cushion, I'm simulating a lateral pelvic obliquity on the cushion there. And then what that looks like on the pressure map is that the pressures are going to be higher on that side. So we want to be able to see which cushion can accommodate a pelvic obliquity like that better. Because if somebody's going to, you know, design a cushion for pelvic obliquities, you want to make sure you can test it and show that it's not going to get these horrible red pressures over on the side where you're. And here it's doing a posterior tilt, so you can see the pressures are increasing in the rear. And then here we have a posterior tilt and an obliquity. So you can see that causes lots of pressure problems. Now, also there's a lot of people that have spasms. I am fortunate that I don't have spasms, and I'm also unfortunate because spasms help with blood circulation. So everything's got a pro and a con to it. But it's difficult to help somebody maintain their position with a spasm in a wheelchair. So we designed this thing called the hip grip. It's a pelvic girdle, essentially. It's a mechanical girdle that goes around the pelvis, and it has a support on the side of it. And in the early prototypes, we had springs and stuff on it to make it spring. So this is what the product ended up looking like. It straps around the person's pelvis, and it goes down to the wheelchair, and then it's got springs and those things on the side. So what it does is it lets you move and do things. So like this is somebody in the Axis dance group up in Berkeley that uses a hip grip as part of
the dancing that she does.
So it allows her to move in her wheelchair and allows her pelvis to move, but also springs her back up into that upright posture, a little bit like the spring rod I showed you in my model ski. So those are the components of it, and that's how it works. And we've licensed this technology to Body Point Designs, and it works pretty well. And when we make things, we test them. So like we had a machine that cycled it like a million times to see if the hinges were going to last. And so that one's available. And the other thing we do when we do our testing is we use human subjects, and we do things like measure how far can this person reach. And so we'll look at them in their regular wheelchair, and they can only reach this much. And then we'll put the hip grip on them and see, wow, this person can reach twice as far with that hip grip on because of the function. So we always look for how to objectively measure the functional increase that the technology is providing someone. And we also look at somebody's reach downward. How far can they reach down to the side before they lose their balance? Another product that we designed that I have on my chair is called a flex room. What we did is we molded the hand rim of the wheelchair to the wheel rim with a flexible layer of urethane rubber. So we say, well, why would you want to do that? Well, basically that gives you a very grippy surface to be able to push on, so I don't have to squeeze that metal hand rim really hard to push my chair. And it also creates a sort of a shock-absorbing hand rim. So if you can imagine, you wear tennis shoes when you go running, right? You wear street shoes for formal occasions. Well, it's sort of like tennis shoes for somebody in a wheelchair because it allows these hand rims to actually to move when you push on them. So there you can see the interface where my thumb and my hand sort of pushes into that rubber, so I don't have to squeeze real hard around this anymore. And then we objectively figured out, okay, let's measure how much that friction improves. And we were able to measure that it doubles the friction on the hand rim by using that. And then we also did impact tests onto the hand rim to make sure that this hand rim wasn't going to just come apart when it was repetitively pushed. So we pushed on it thousands of times until we broke the hand rim to see how far, you know, 500,000 cycles. So we didn't think we had a problem there. And then we do various physiological things. So we had a wheelchair biomechanics lab. So we got our subject all set up on the treadmill, and the treadmill's tilted, simulating going up a grade. We've got this guy instrumented with the markers like you guys used in the lab to look at, you know, to make the little stick figure on the computer. So we're looking at how we change the biomechanics of the propulsion pushing the wheelchair when we change the wheels on this person's chair. And of course we're measuring metabolic measures, we're measuring the expired gases to see how much oxygen is being used to actually push the chair. We're monitoring the heart rate, we're measuring electrodes on the hand, EMG electrodes, and we're doing motion capture with the little marker triangles on the person. And then the wheel is actually measuring the torque that's being applied in three axes, the X, Y, and Z axis on the hand rim itself. Too many arrows. So there's the wheel that we made, the instrumented wheel. It's basically a six-axis load cell that the hand rim is mounted to with those beams, and that allows us to measure the torque. So that's the product, and the other benefit that it has is you can squeeze through really narrow doorways because the hand rims actually squish in about an inch on each side to let you go through a really super narrow door. We actually worked on another product called a grip rim, and it's a rubber sleeve that goes around the hand rim with little pieces of hard plastic inside. So it'll slide when you're going downhill, but then when you start to push on it, the rubber deforms and squeezes on the hand rim and slows you down. So it's sort of like for a quadriplegic or something that can't grip the hand rim really well. It's sort of like a power grip assist, basically. So adaptive paddling. I'm a kayaker. I had a seat kayak that I used to use in Santa Cruz Harbor. I had a molded seat that fit me, and I wore a seatbelt in there. There's a lot of adaptive water sports programs all over the country that would like to be able to do this. So we designed this seat that's now commercially available. It has a base of support with hip pads that support on the side, and then for people that need the upper pads, it gives more support. So it pretty much straps into a regular canoe seat,
attaches right on top of the seat that's there, and it can bracket onto the side of the canoes. It has the lower back support and pelvic support to hold the pelvis in position. And then for some people, for the higher injury user, it's going to have those upper back and lateral supports up on the sides under the arms. So it's a real modular system that could be adjusted. So we needed to measure the functional benefits. So we have it hooked up to a Concept 2 ergometer here that's been modified for paddling with a paddle. And this guy's trying to achieve a targeted paddling rate that he's doing. And then we have the canoe on rollers, so it's rocking back and forth with a motor to simulate being in the water. So we're trying to make this as real as possible. So this is the product that it ended up with. There's a Chosen Valley Canoe Accessories is making this product available. And we put this into the public domain because these high-risk products are manufactured by these little family-owned businesses that have no product liability insurance. And so we're just happy to see it out there. They send us a new seat every once in a while, and it's available for people. So, again, how do we test it? We hook the person up to the metabolic system to measure their expired gases. And we can also measure their rating of perceived exertion, which corresponds with heart rate, and we can measure the difficulty ratings that they come up with. So they paddle away on the, and we also do a maximum force paddle to see what's the strongest force they can paddle with. Then we measure their lateral balance with the seat, and people were able to go to like 2 or 3 times the angle with this seat than they could with a standard sort of Renona type strap-on canoe seat system. And then we made sure that this didn't impede them getting out of the canoe when it actually tips over. You don't want the feeding system working so well that it holds them in perfectly upside down in the water. You want them to get out when it flips over upside down. So we checked for all of that. We also worked on a wave. I had a student that worked on a wave ski at the University of Virginia project. Now I'm going to shift from adaptive technology to environmental technologies, and I'm going to talk about accessibility of the outdoor environment. And
what time is class over there?
We are on here at 5:30, but what I was thinking is maybe we'll stop at 5:30 and people can easily look at that time.
Okay. Okay.
And if there's like a favorite thing on here that you want to ask about too, this handout has a list of everything that I've shown on there. Hopefully I'll have one. So you can be marking the ones you want to ask more questions about, or if you want to email questions, you can do that, or if you want to talk to me afterwards or come to dinner, you're welcome to talk to me more about any of the projects. And we have internships at Beneficial Designs people come up and work there, so if you're interested in doing more with Beneficial Designs, you can let me know. So we're going to shift into the, I think I'm on the back page now, into the universal trail assessment process. And that's where we systematically measure the grade, the crawl slope, and the surface information about the trail. We use real simple tools, smart level, clinometer, measuring tape and things. We systematically measure the grade, the crawl slope, the width, the surface firmness and stability, and the length of the trail. And we record that information, and we train people how to do that so they can go out in teams of 2 to do the work. And we've trained over 1,200 people since we started this process, and we've got 155 trainers. So we continue to run about 3 to 4 of these workshops a year, training people how to go out and assess outdoor environments for accessibility. They put the data into what we call TrailWare. It's the software we built for processing the data, and all the features go in there as well, the ruts, the roots, the rocks, and picnic tables and things that are along the trail. And to speed up the process, we designed this jogging stroller system called the High Efficiency Trail Assessment Process, and it's got a sensor box either on the cart or the wheel that measures the grade and crawl slope, and then the wheel is measuring the distance, and then the software is just sucking in all the data on the laptop. So one person can go out and do this like 5 times faster than 2 people can do it with the manual tools. So we've started selling these. We've sold about 17 of these systems that are out there. Just Jeremy, one of our trail assessment coordinators, and we could also put it on an ATV. So if it's an ATV trail, you want to measure it with an ATV footprint for the grade and crossover. So we put the sensors on the ATV and make the measurements with that. So it depends on what the trail is going to be used for. This is the user interface. It's got the tread width, the surface type, it's paved, surface type ice. It must have been cold that morning. Distance and grade and crossover. So we're continuously recording that, and then the last station is over here, so you can see the live data, and then you record that data, and it pops over to the left. Then you measure your features. These are the ruts, roots, or rocks, and you measure the length, width, and height of the features, and the description of them. We have pull-down menus. You pull down the feature you're recording. We also measure playgrounds for accessibility. If you think about it, a playground has to be soft enough that it's safe, so when you fall off the highest piece of equipment, you don't get a head injury, but it's got to be firm and stable enough that you can roll on it. So that's a challenge. So we designed this system where we use an instrumented wheel rolling across the playground surface to measure the torque, and then we can roll around a turning guide as well to measure the turning, the stability. When you try to turn on the surface really, if it's unstable, it comes all apart and you start to sink in it. So we measure those things, and then we've started actually doing this measurement out in the field to see how well the lab measurements, here we are measuring in the hangar, doing a lab measurement compared to the field measurement. And we've written a standard for that, an AFTM standard for playground accessibility, F1951. We're working on a portable device because we really want to be able to go out and measure in the field easier. So this is a wheelchair caster that's the indenter. It's got a precision spring up here. You release the spring and it indents into the surface. So we measure with precision the indentation in the surface. That gives us the firmness reading. And then we swing this handle back and forth four times. And if it's on an unstable surface, it digs way down in there and you can see the stability reading. And all the measurements on this device correlate with the wheelchair measurement method that I showed you earlier. So we think we've got a good chance of getting this to be a standard because of its correlation. So typical trail, this is up at Tahoe Rim Trail. This section here was real unstable, was kind of soft material. So we dug it all out. We put in this gravel paved path plastic structure, filled it all back in, get it all back in there. You can't even really see it. But it creates this structure in the soft, sandy surface that allows you to roll over it and be completely firm and stable. So there's a lot of good products being developed, and there it is when it's all finished, that improve the firmness and stability of the trail without environmentally impacting it a lot. Using the same material to go back in there because it's in the Tahoe Basin, we don't want any non-native materials washing into Lake Tahoe, so we're using the same native material. So here you can see firmness readings are real low, about 0.2 inches. The stability readings were off the scale. They were like 0.8 or 0.9 inches. After we put the gravel pave in, the stability is down to half that, 0.4 inches of penetration. So you can see how we can objectively measure the stability of the surface. The firmness didn't really change. It was the stability that changed. Here's another trail in the meadow there where just lots of problems because, you know, this is it's a meadow, so in the spring the water's coming through and it's like, oh, this is wet, I'll walk over here, and then the water starts flowing over there. So every time somebody'd walk in a new place, there's a new braided stream occurring. So we built a boardwalk out there. So our company actually designed the boardwalk and installed it on this Forest Service property. We used the same boardwalk design that Yellowstone Park uses with the stringers and the 2x6s across it and the weenie rails on the side. And it's 6 feet wide with the rails, so there's 5 foot for people to pass in wheelchairs on the boardwalk. So it's really, really nice. So it's really transformed the meadow because all this bad stuff that was going on is all grown back in, and this will grow back in right there where people were walking there too. Another issue is how do you keep motorized vehicles off the trail but still allow hikers on the trail? Well, they just go, well, we'll just leave this little tiny space there and the hikers can just kind of slip through, and it's like, excuse me, I'd like to use the trail. So we thought, well, how could we design a trail gate barrier? So we came up with this sort of what we call the inverted bollard design. It's wider in the bottom and it's narrow up top, so it makes it tough for the motorcyclers to get through. We also came up with an infrared camera that can detect some of the agencies just want to, like, see the offender and catch the offender. So they want to detect them and go get them. So we made it as a combination trail counter and vehicle detector for use on trails. So we take all this data and we make what we call trail access information. So this has the typical grade, the maximum grade, typical crosswalk maximum. So all of this access information and goes into different kinds of signage. We call this our trail access information strip. We sort of tried to pattern it after, you know, the food facts label on the cereal box to have this nice objective information, and we put it on these fiberglass pieces and they go up on 4x4 posts. This is what they look like out in the field. So there's a 4x4 post with the trail access information. And then these are what the panel signs look like. So the panel signs, this is the whole park, and the different colors of trails all have different trail access information that you can look up. So I can see, okay, the trail that goes down along the river, that one's horribly, that's sand, that's going to be really soft. I can see that this one's really firm and stable, so I think I'll go hike on this one. So you can look objectively at what the grades and crosslopes are and decide where you're going to hike or which wheelchair you're going to use. You're going to use your regular wheelchair or the hiking wheelchair, or whether you're going to need one friend along or three friends along to help you through the soft parts. So that's what it looks like. And we've measured every state park in the state of Nevada, and we are currently in the process of printing that signage and sending it out to be installed at all the state parks in Nevada. So it's kind of exciting because we've got, these are just some samples of the different maps that we've designed, and these are all 3x4 foot fiberglass impregnated panel maps that will last 10 years out in the sun. And so we've been keeping our trail assessment coordinator busy. We also have a website where the information gets downloaded to, and you can put in the types of trails you're looking for and the state you're looking for them and get back a report on, well, these are the trails that meet all the conditions that you're interested in. So we've actually made some design standards for accessible trails, and the Access Board is working on guidelines, you know, specifying, okay, you can have this grade for a certain length to be accessible, you can have a 5% cross slope, you need passing spaces at these intervals, etc. So there are design standards if they want to design a trail that's going to have accessibility. There's also a concept called an outdoor recreation access route that is for linking things like campgrounds to picnic areas to bathrooms to boat launches, etc. What about the built environment? Curb ramps. Curb ramps are these things that, like, are supposed to make it easier to go from the street to the gutter back up onto the sidewalk. Some of them, when the ramp gets really steep and the gutter gets really steep, it's like you've got this really steep downslope followed by this really steep upslope. For a lot of powered wheelchairs, it's a recipe for flipping someone over backwards if you go through it too fast. And so there are design standards for them. And so we realize we need to figure, and there's more than just wheelchairs. We're talking strollers, walkers, crutch cane users. So we came up with this sidewalk assessment process using the same tools to measure the grade on the ramp and the gutter and everything and the flares that are off on the side of the ramps and the approach to the curb ramp in the street. And we measure the lengths and widths of the panels and see if it's meeting all the design specs. And then there's these things that you probably just call them upheavals, but they're basically tripping hazards that exist all over the sidewalks where the sidewalks move. They're kind of tricky to measure because you've got to use a profile gauge, trace it on a piece of paper, and measure it. Well, anything over a quarter of an inch is a tripping hazard that needs to be beveled with a concrete grinder to make it so it's not going to trip somebody. So we decided we're going to design an automated sidewalk assessment process. So we divide the system up into zones, the crossing zones and the sidewalk zones along the buildings. And so we've got now a system that's got the same sort of sensor box, but we've got a GPS on there and camera and distance sensor to measure all this stuff in the sidewalk environment. So this really cuts down on the time because there's a lot more measurements that have to be made in the sidewalk environment. So we've also got a portable wireless roller wheel that sends the data to the cart. And we've got a height measurement device to measure all those tripping hazards. So all you have to do is just punch this thing down across the tripping hazard, and it automatically measures the height and sends it over to the laptop computer to measure the tripping hazards. This is, by a lot of cities, this has been identified as the highest liability for the city, because when somebody trips on it, they're like, huh, okay, it's over half an inch. The person tripped, they broke their hip. Looks like you're going to have to pay the bill, because you should have ground it down. So this is a real high liability issue for cities, and so we want a high efficiency way to measure it quickly. So this is what our user interface looks like for the software, and it's capturing these pictures as you're going down automatically down the system, and it shows you, like, it says put the cart on the ramp, on the curb ramp. Here you see the flares, and then it's going to say, okay, there he is, putting the cart on the ramp, measuring the grade. And then it says put it on this part of the ramp, now put it on the landing, now put it on the approach, now put it on the close approach, now put it on the flare. So you literally just move the cart around, hit the enter key, and you're grabbing the grade cross hope on all those features to verify that it meets the access standards. So it's pretty cool. It saves lots and lots of time. So we're setting it up in a SQL database and export. We also want to be able to export the data into GIS information files. So there's a GPS position. So here you can see all the data points that are collected for this data. All the blue circles are driveway crossings, and all the yellow ones are the curb ramps. So this stuff just overlays right into the GIS maps, and they can create basically a GIS layer for sidewalks. And here you can see all of our other symbols that are on there for the different, all the other features that are on the sidewalk. We also have a publishing company called PAX Press, and so we write publications like Manual Wheelchair Training Guide, How to Train Your Manual Wheelchair to Get the Newspaper, and all those good things, How to Set Up and Adjust the Wheelchair, Figuring Out What Your Limits Are Using the Chair, How to Propel Your Wheelchair Efficiently and Fast, How to Do a Wheelie and Balance, how to pop a wheelie, you know, lots and lots of illustrations, how to get through doors, thresholds, how to deal with ramps, how to deal with curb cuts, especially when it's raining and they fill up with water, how to get up a curb, how to jump up a curb with speed, how to assist somebody, how to ride an escalator in a wheelchair, that's even possible. Evacuation procedures if there's a fire or a 911 situation. Ways of hiking. I've got pole straps on my chair. And then accessories to do all sorts of fun things that wheelchairs are going to be designed to do eventually. And then we have standards for measuring wheelchairs. Manual and powered wheelchairs. Lots of different sections to them. Static stability, dynamic stability, braking, energy consumption. Just like cars go through testing. There's a simple static stability test when you can pull the paper out from under the uphill wheels. It's about ready to fall over. We already talked about the testing machines. We've written books on how to fit somebody to a wheelchair, how to measure somebody properly to get the right width, to get the right seat height, to get the right seat angle, to get the right axle position so you can reach the wheels, to push the chair efficiently. And there's lots and lots of, people that are using chairs and trying to get around in outdoor environments. So our company was asked to help create design standards for how sidewalks and trails should be built. So we did this for federal highways, designing them. Sidewalks have detectable warnings, those are the bumps for somebody that's using a cane to navigate with a visual impairment to find where the transition into the street is. Designing, zones to keep away from the building, having a proper pedestrian zone. You can't have overhangs for people that are visually impaired to whack into. Lots of subtle things that go into designing the pedestrian environment to be friendly and safe. Driveway crossings are probably the most difficult thing. With those flares on the side, if you can't go around them, you end up on three wheels, and the wheelchair just tends to dive down into the street on a driveway crossing. Grates, making sure the grates don't suck people's wheels into them. We're also working on design standards for fitness equipment. So like a lot of fitness equipment has, like this one has this little tiny seat on there. So it's impossible for Mike here. He's got a spinal cord injury. He can't even hardly balance on the seat, not to mention exercise. Treadmills need lower step heights for getting on and off. The hand grips on this guy, can't even get your hand around it to hold on to it. So it needs a proper grip that you can hold on to it. If you have a visual impairment, if the pin's black, you're not going to be able to see it. So good contrast on the equipment and the controls. Pins that don't require fine finger function so that somebody without good finger function can adjust them. Speaking of contrast, this is a control panel on a treadmill. You can see it in color, and then watch what happens in black and white. There's no light to dark contrast, so anybody that's colorblind isn't going to be able to see that panel, whereas this one, you can see it in color, and then you can actually see it in black and white because there's a good color contrast, the light to dark contrast. So we're actually writing an ASTM standard for how to measure color contrast using a light meter that's going through the development process. And the last thing I was going to mention is we're now working on how to measure consumer products for people with cognitive impairment. So if you have something like a camera or a cell phone, there's simple ones and there's complicated ones. But if somebody's older, or somebody doesn't have a cognitive, it's a head injury from Iraq or Afghanistan or something, you need to keep things simple. So we're looking at ways that we can measure consumer products, microwaves, cameras, phones, fire extinguishers, to identify them as being simple to use versus more complex to use and figure out how to do that. So that covers the main presentation. I think we're out of time. We have time for a couple questions.
Peter, I always thought that you invented the ski sledding system so you'd be the first one into that sport and win all the medals.
I did.
Is there any truth to that?
Yeah, I did for a while. Got the medal in the three world championships.
Excellent. And I should mention that Peter was at the closing ceremony for the Olympics up in Vancouver.
Yeah, that actually what happened was, I mentioned we put the recreation stuff in the public domain, and the White House found out that we had actually done that with all the monoskis and stuff that we designed. And so they invited me to be part of the White House delegation at the Olympics. They were looking for people that had, made... You had to be a gold medal winner.
Yeah.
And then you had to, have done something else with your life since then. So I was there with Christy Yamaguchi and Bonnie Blair and Kathleen Sebelius and Janet Napolitano and all our current Janice Rice and current folks out there in Washington.
Does anybody have any questions for Peter?
Yes, Dr. Stableman.
Working around hospitals, all our careers, and hospitals turn out to be some of the worst examples of good environmental design around that we've got. Everybody's late for an appointment, the doctors and the patients. The patients are all sick, so they can't afford to wait.
I'm mostly an outdoor environment, outdoor products type of person, except for maybe the piano pedal for sure. But so that hasn't been my expertise. There's a whole special interest group within RESNA, the Rehab Engineering Society, that does focus on design of built environments, and there's people that are experts in that, and so I kind of saw that area was pretty well taken care of, but wasn't aware of this. I hadn't thought much about the unique challenges of a hospital environment. But
we've got sidewalks where two people with canes can't walk past them,
right?
Much less in a chair.
Yep. Yeah, you have to have that 5 foot passing space for. Continuous. That's why we made that boardwalk 5 feet the whole way. So we would always recommend 5 feet. If I can only get the Reno Airport to put in 5 foot sidewalks to their parking lot, then I'll be all set. But I have been unsuccessful in making that happen. Yeah. Yeah, I got a list of things. If you're interested in working on them, I'll show you the list.
Well, maybe the class might work on that.
Yeah, Arnon knows better too. He's worked on a lot of these projects that you all saw there. So one of our past employee consultant contractors right here. Berta. Trying to think of who else.
Yeah. Right.
What role does your family play in your work?
They get to test new and innovative new ideas. Actually, my daughter went with me. I designed the reasonable accommodations for all the amusement park rides. So I've worked on about a dozen rides at Disney and Universal, both at each place. So Jurassic Park was one of their older rides. Usually I work on the new rides about 5 years before they open. I'm in a warehouse somewhere transferring in and out of a plywood mock-up, trying to figure out how to modify that roller coaster to make it so you can transfer down into that ride easier. And so when we start at the early stage, that makes it a lot easier. But when we're retrofitting old rides, well, Jurassic Park is an old ride. And so the new ADA went into effect April 15th for amusement parks. And so we were fast and furiously designing an accommodation for Jurassic Park. So we made it's a water ride. So you got to get down to a boat, basically. So we designed a transfer tier that plugs onto the side of the boat. And then you transfer 1, 2, 3 times, 7-inch transfers to get down into that ride. And so when we went back to test it, my daughter came along with another helper. And so they videoed us as a family getting in and out of the ride, both with assistance and without assistance, to show how to do the transfer. And then they're going to use that video in the waiting area where you're getting to touch that seat and look at it and think about how you're going to do it and watch the actual video of how you do that process. Because if somebody can see how it's supposed to happen, you only have about 45 to 60 seconds to do it in the real world situation. And we found if you can practice it once, you can cut the time in half for getting in and out of the ride. And so my daughter got to help test the Jurassic Park ride, and she was quite scared about it too because she was only 8 years old at the time. Once she did the first ride around, and they wanted to do it again with me getting in and out independently, and she's like, yeah, she was excited to do that. So we got in and out of the ride twice and rode it twice. And then the zip line thing, I'd never done that, so we've actually got the pictures from that, and they have been asked to write an article about that for Sports and Spokes magazine, how to do a zip line safely. You know, if you're in a wheelchair, what are the precautions you need to take, and how do you do it? And definitely, because every time you have to be able to pull yourself up to unweight it, to unhook you from the cable, and then you have to sit down on something. So they use that aluminum motorcycle stand, and I was sitting on this little stand, and then my daughter would come in and kind of slide the stand around to hook up onto the next cable. But once I would hook up onto the cable, I pretty much had to hold myself there while the other guy took the stand, slid out, went across first, and then I could go across and then pull myself off again and get off. So it was a lot of chin-up kind of thing. It was fun. You know, I ordered one of those in the Stanford magazine. I read about the Ruminate product. Do you guys know about the Ruminate girls? Are the Ruminate girls here somewhere? Stanford still? The Ruminate girls designed this. Three students in that class that does a product in 1 quarter, I think. And they sell this erector set, design your own room with motors and stuff. I just got her a Ruminate. She's been having a blast with it. That's her favorite thing right now, reconfiguring her Ruminate into different configurations. And I went out online last night and ordered the extra electrical kit to add more electronics to the Ruminate. And it's her best friend's birthday party, so she wants a Ruminate for her. So I ordered another Ruminate for them. And so she's mechanical, but she loves to read. And I'm not a big reader, but she's got like 500 reading points or something. So I don't know, some kind of combination of reading and designing or something. But I don't know. So,
Dale.
Dale?
So I really like your three-wheel sidewalk system.
Yeah, the carts.
Yeah, I wonder what is the response to that kind of all of the
cities, they can't wait to get their hands on the system because the cost of doing it is so astronomical on people's bodies too. Every measurement you have to with the smartphone, you're gonna kneel down and measure that grain and cross up, and then you're kneeling down in about 10 places on every program. So I think it's just gonna really save tons and tons of time. So there's lots of engineering firms want to buy it because the engineering firms are the ones that are going to do the work. Some cities want to buy it because they're just going to have staff do it. And a lot of them want to just contract us to send people there to measure it for them. So we see a service that we can provide with that will potentially help generate revenue for us. And so we made a decision to go wireless with all the sensors. So we had to we're redesigning some of our systems. Basically, we've created a USB wireless serial interface box that plugs in the USB port, and this little cigarette pack size thing can receive lots and lots of wireless signals. And then it also can plug in things. So we've got the GPS plugging in to that signal, but it's going to receive the distance encoder, the grain, the crosslope. It'll receive wireless. The height measurement device will come in wireless. The portable roll wheel will come in wireless. So everything's going to come in wireless now, and that'll allow us to make it easier to put on other because sometimes they want to put it on an ATV or they want to put it on a vehicle and go do, you know, BLM's got thousands of miles of roads they haven't even inventoried. So this is that way they could inventory those for their condition as well. So,
is this going to be open source?
Pieces of it are open source and pieces of it are not. So the communication protocols on the wireless thing are open source so that if for industries they want to bring in lots of other wireless signals in, they can use that. The communication protocol on it is going to be open source. The guy that's doing the electronics design for us is pretty clever. Martin's working on it with him as well.
Once you start sending teams out,
the
TMT
vehicle
wheelchair?
Yeah, you just put the equipment on the wheelchair. Yeah. So, you put the sensor box, install it on the laptop in my lap. I'm the sensor. Yeah, we just got a call from Hawaii. So Hawaii needs us to send people to Maui for a couple weeks. So if we can get you trained, somebody fell off one of the trails and died. So they want to get their trails measured pretty quick. So here today, gone to Maui. So we think that they might buy. They're trying to have us show the cost analysis of buying the equipment versus us just doing it for them. By the time they buy all the equipment, they'll have it all set up. So we're trying to make it sort of like they can decide which way they want to go with it. But they've got an incredible range of trails, and it rains a lot there in certain parts, and some of it turns into mud, surface when it gets wet. So it's a challenge. The idea is 20%. You would inventory every 20% every year. So you're every 5 years, you're sort of reassessing things.
Last question.
Yeah. Yeah, you can come try them out. That's a good question. It does add a little bit to the weight of the chair, but the mechanical hardware is gone, so it's just the additional weight from the hand rim. It's really, really close. It's not quite as light as your lightest lightweight wheel, but to compensate, it's on a wheel that only has 12 spokes. And they're fiber spokes that you can tie in a knot. So the wheel itself is lighter, but this piece of rubber makes it slightly heavier, so it's sort of balancing out. As far as like a normal composite wheel, it's lighter than that. You know, the all plastic wheels that a lot of wheel stores have on us, this wheel is lighter than that. But it's heavier than a really super lightweight wheel. Sort of a... Yeah, there are chairs with suspensions in them. And some of them are designed to do the swimming pool thing, you know, and the skate park thing where you jump into swimming pools. If you go online and do wheelchair backflips, you'll see
this little young guy with spina bifida that's done a backflip in his wheelchair and stuff like that. So they're building chairs just for skate parks. But if you just need a little bit of suspension, there's a couple chairs out there that do that. But I think that using the pneumatic tires on all four wheels, really, that's the suspension I wanted. It gives me enough suspension. It's usually the hard wheels in the front that really kind of knock your fillings out.
So, your front casters have air?
Yeah. Yeah, they're 6-inch pneumatic tires. And they're really hard to change the tire, so I actually carry a whole wheel in my luggage. So if I get a flat tire, I just take the wheel off and put another wheel on. Let the guys at the shop change it when I get back.
I think we should thank Peter one more time.
All right.
Show of hands, how many people are interested in going to dinner with us?
1, 2, 3, 4, 6.
Okay, great. So if anybody needs a ride, we have a car service to that. And I just want to make sure that you have an opportunity to sign up for a tour on Tuesday and sign in if you haven't done so already.
Come on down if you want to ask any other questions. I'll be here for a little bit.
And have a great weekend.
Hi, Gail.
I can't make it here today, but I'm really glad to see you.
Thank you for coming over.